The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
All right. So today's reading comes from a game designer, Louis Pulsifer, who's traditionally working war games. I believe he's done some of the board games as well, but for the most part, I think he's recognized for his wargaming work. And there's actually quite a lot of wargaming journals, mostly written by designers for fans or by fans for fans. Things like The Complete Strategist used to be like the PC Gamer of wargaming, right? You know, it's like, this is what's happening, and these are our thoughts, these are our critiques. And that particular reading, I feel, is very typical of that sort of era of maybe late 80s, early to mid 90s magazine publications. And it's interesting because already at that time, sure, there are people who, say, wrote the core rule sets for various games like, you know, Axis and Allies or things like Dungeons and Dragons, but there was going to be this assumption that if you're interested in something like wargaming, you're also interested in creating your own scenarios. You are already halfway a game designer. And so you have to keep all of these things in mind. If you're a game master, has anyone been like a dungeon master or a game master for a role-playing group? Okay. You're basically a game designer.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you're taking rule sets that somebody else came and cherry-picking the stuff that you really want to work with and discarding the stuff that doesn't and then coming up with your own rules. So just as a sample of reading, because I believe this is the first time I've asked you to read anything from the tabletop book.
Second time?
Yeah. Oh, okay, all right.
So randomness first.
That's true, yeah. This particular piece of reading is also a nice little time capsule of how people used to write about game design. It's a fairly modern piece of writing, but still, it still has that same sort of style. So there's a lot of examples of, like, this is how this theoretical game is going to be played, and I'm going to write it out completely in prose. You know, it's not going to say, and even when it talks, when they refer to games that already exist, like I believe they do cite Vinci at one point.
Britannia.
Yeah, they explain the mechanics that they're discussing out in prose. It's not like in point form or anything like that. It's just free prose. I don't think there was ever any assumption that, you know, if you contributed an essay for something like The Complete Strategist, that diagrams that you included will be included into the magazine, right? Because a lot of people who actually created those essays weren't necessarily artists. And that's not to say that you didn't have diagrams in magazines like that, but it was expensive. This is before desktop publishing. So people just got really, really used to describing things in prose, describing core game mechanics in prose, not even point form or bullet points. So there were basically two suggestions that he has on how to deal with the whole three-player problem. You know, that, like, before I get into his suggestions, can anyone quickly sum up what's the main problem with having designing a game for three players?
One of them was Turtles, where two of the players sort of go at it for most of the game, and then they weaken themselves, and then the third player just sits back, just comes in and beats them up.
Okay, so that's for a certain set of rules, that's one kind of strategy which encourages you to basically not interact with anybody else and then win the game, right?
I was going to say there's positions where if just one player chooses which the other two players wins.
Mm-hmm. So I believe kingmaking was the name that was given to that. You may not be in a position to win the game, but in a game with only three players, you might have enough influence to basically say, I don't like you, therefore you are not going to win. Therefore the other person's going to win, even though I can win. Right? There were a few more sort of like subtle problems that he described. Anyone remember any of that? One? Yeah.
like politics. So if two people decide to team up on the other player pretty much can't win.
He actually brought, he brought that up. This it does come up in a reading. It's not necessarily described as a problem, but something that does happen, and happens often. So you either take advantage of it, or as a designer, or your game suffers because you hadn't thought about it. Right, this whole idea of somebody's in the lead and two people probably want to do a temporary alliance at the very least, right, to take down that player. There was one called sandbagging, and I'm actually forgetting what that means here.
I think it said that saying that you're going less well off than you actually are.
Oh yeah, pretending that you are bordering on lying, right? You know, on this like, no, I'm not gonna win the game in the next turn. Don't worry about me. Deal with him. He's scarier, you know, and that sort of like, sort of deceit, where you have to like actively conceal the fact that you are not in the lead. Then there are some games that say, all right, here are some ways that you can do that. I'm not sure. Are we having a play crunch? I think we are. Yeah. So Crunch is a game about being a banker during trying to fill up your golden parachute before the market crashes. You are encouraged to play the game in a 3-piece suit so that you can actually actively hide cards. And the idea is that at the end of the game, the amount of money that you've managed to sequester for your own personal use, including any cards that you have hidden on yourself, will win you the game. It's not about keeping your banks afloat at all. It's all about leaving with the largest personal fortune. So it's this wry satirical game, but that one actively encourages you to conceal how well you're performing. Now it's a two-player game. It's not like a three-player thing. So that you are also well aware that your opponent is doing the same sort of thing. You're just trying to do the best that you can in accumulating as much cash as possible because that's what's going to win you a game. But in a situation with three players, you can imagine a situation where if someone could figure out that you're in the lead and that person couldn't catch up, then you know what can they do, like pass cards to the player that they want to win, you know, for instance. And that might be tough because someone might not be able to interfere with that process.
In the game Junta, there's you're a politician in some Latin American banana republic,
mm-hmm.
and your goal is to embezzle as much foreign aid money as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things is that the amount of foreign aid money drawn each turn is variable, and like only the president really knows.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, that's one of the parts of the game is that sometimes like the president won't draw very much,
right.
which might like cause evil to launch a coup against him because they think he's lying and taking a lot for himself and they're scared of him winning for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
But like, yeah, basically there's so much uncertainty about how much people, like it's not even computable how much people have in there.
This is Junta?
Junta, yeah.
With a J, right?
Yeah.
So it is neat, right? It sort of plays around with this idea that, you know, you have this dictator that's seems to be amassing a large personal fortune. Whether or not the dictator that is actually being successful in the process of amassing a bit large personal fortune, that game is designed to paint a giant target. And we have another game here called King of Tokyo, which is basically giant monsters trying to take over the bay, Tokyo Bay. Every single generic giant robot, giant dinosaur, octopus thing, mecha dinosaur, and whoever happens to be on King of the Hill at that point has a giant target on them. And the game mechanics all support that. That's what the game's all about. So those were some of the problems. And he proposes two solutions, not necessarily the only two solutions, but these are the ones that occurs to him, that in particularly in the wargaming scenario might work. And they're actually kind of opposite ends of the spectrum. Anyone remember one of those two solutions?
City equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
Making it so that if one person gets ahead, then I think they cannot be significantly defeated before they win the game.
I think equilibrium was the opposite of that.
Opposite.
Yeah. So you've actually just completed two answers into one, which is good. So the equilibrium, if I recall correctly from the reading, the equilibrium method was, or design goal, let's say, like if you manage to design that, is taking advantage of things like the balance of power theory, which is if there is a person who's clearly ahead, everybody else who is weaker is probably going to band up and take you down. And if you balance the game in a certain way, you give them the tools to do that, and thus take anyone who seems to be ahead back to a sort of equal power level. That's balance of power theory is something from political science. I've only heard about it in passing. If there's anybody here who's taken political science classes, you can tell me if I'm getting this right or wrong. But the whole thing is not a far-fetched idea, right? You know, if you've got a powerful nation, other nations who are bordering that powerful nation are likely to either team up with the powerful nation or more likely to band their energies together, even though they may not be ideologically linked or anything. They're ideologically linked against the powerful nation. You know? So the same thing goes for players. So basically it comes down to giving everybody the tool to take down the leader a notch. And does restore everything to a sort of equilibrium state. And then your success criteria for the game probably isn't who's going to gain such a massive lead. Because the game is deliberately designed to restore everything to equilibrium, you need to have some other kinds of success criteria. Maybe the game is time limited, for instance. Maybe the game has different goals for each player or something. So even though your power levels are about the same, you might be able to accomplish, get victory points or something faster than others. What about the alternative, which you hinted at, which was basically making it difficult to take down the person who's in the lead once they're already in the lead. So he had one very specific implementation of this, or one particular rule of thumb on how effective must a person in the lead be in order to prevent the kingmaking and the sandbagging and totally everything. Remember this? Well, the basic idea is that you must be able to do it in one turn, in a single turn. You should be able to, if you are in the lead, you should be able to complete the game and win the game in a single turn. I'm not so sure whether I agree with that. But I don't think he means win it on your turn. I think it means like in a round of people. Like by the time, if you're in the lead in the game, you should be able to do something that to cement that lead so that within that turn, no one's going to be able to do anything about it and you should be able to fill up the game. This is for games where there is like a clear win condition that's based on overpowering your opponents. Then you don't want to have this situation where, yeah, I'm in the lead, but everybody else still has enough time to take me down to the point that somebody else can then catch up and be in the lead. Because that basically means that that the first person to get in the lead will probably lose. And that's sad. But we've seen that in certain computer games. We've seen games where, you know, whoever who is in the lead has a giant target painted on their back and you know, you're expected to be taken down. If you're the first one in the lead, you are probably going to get hit, but then that now gives you enough time to be able to pull ahead. So that's closer to the equilibrium style, right? So I think I heard someone Mario Kart being the obvious one. You know, you get increasingly powerful weapons the further behind you get, or useful things. There's an example in this book here, the Rules of Play. This is the paperback version. Hardback version of Super Monkey Ball, and basically all their weapons face forward. So if you're number one, you can only shoot forward. There's nothing to shoot. There's nobody ahead of you. So it's not actually it's not a technical disadvantage. It's not like a weapon that slows you down, but you know it's a useless thing. You get these power ups that are useless. So a lot of these feed into a different way of looking at games that is very formal, very techie, and one that you probably heard of mentioned multiple times in this class and in other classes as well, and that's just feedback systems. I'm not talking about UI feedback. I'm talking about feedback from a cybernetic sense. Anyone here heard about cybernetics from another class? Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll just go with the feedback systems that you used in your the other class that we did, design video games.
Yeah. I definitely brought it up.
Yeah, where you had a forward feedback system and backward feedback system, mm-hmm. for basically
positive and negative. Yeah.
If you were winning, you either start winning by more, or mm-hmm. you're losing, you start to catch up.
Right. So that's the whole basic idea of cybernetics is based on sort of automated control. You know, you've got you create systems, mechanical or electronic, or with a set of rules that are basically going to either accelerate or snowball the performance of the system or bring it back to equilibrium. If this sounds very familiar to something in Mackey or EE or something, that's completely expected. Because this all originally came from that anyway. So the basic model is that you have some sort of sensor, something that detects an environmental change. It could be something that detects the state of your game. Some way of telling you this is the current state that you're looking at. That goes to a comparator, which is needs more space because it's a longer word. Comparator, which performs some sort of logical assessment on the state of the system that you're looking at. And then you go into an actuator. Which performs some sort of action. And it's called feedback because this thing just keeps feeding back. Right? Real life systems that do this. Like, what are some of the simplest real life systems that do this? Like, electronically or mechanically without human knowledge, without human intervention?
Washing machine?
Thermostat. Washing machine does that with wet water levels, I think, right?
Well, if it shakes too much, it stops.
Oh, yeah. That's true. So much that things get too hot, turn on the cooling system, you know, or shut off the heating system.
I wonder if like that emergency drain in the sinks.
Emergency?
Sure.
Like, yeah.
The little, there's like a hole at the top of sinks where like if the water gets on the tube around there.
Yeah. The sensors, you know, whether the water has actually hit that hole, you know, and on the edge. I guess the sensor is the level of the water. The comparator is it at the height of the hole, and then the actuator is if it's at the height of the hole, go out the hole, right? So it's actually just like physics is the entire system for you. But it's been engineered in a way to take advantage of that.
Systems like autopilot.
Just sort of keeping you on the path that you're supposed to be, and it's always just doing minute little corrections. Majority of these things are real world applications of these negative feedback systems. So, and the idea is that, you know, if there is a change in one direction, pull it back. You know, if it goes in the other direction, pull it forward, so that it always sort of hovers around the same point. These are like deliberately designed systems trying to do this all the time. But there are a lot of real world systems that do the opposite, right? Stuff that snowballs. For instance, a snowball rolling down the hill. You know, as it goes down, it gets larger, and it makes it slightly easier to continue rolling. I think surface area in contact to the snow actually decreases, at least from a ratio point of view, makes it easier to keep rolling. And then it picks up more snow, and it gets larger and larger and larger. Other positive feedback systems in real world?
I don't know the name of the game, but there's this where you start off as an asteroid.
Astro, bro.
Is that what it is?
Astro what?
It's like you start off as like a small asteroid, mm-hmm. and what happens is that you eat other small asteroids and you grow up to be a planet. And then at that point,
asteroids become really easy to gobble up, but you want to go after other smaller planets than you, and then eventually you become the sun. And then you keep on getting bigger until you become a black hole. And then eventually you get so large that you just eat everything on that.
So there are two games that reminds me of. One is Orbital, which was a Nintendo game. Do you know?
Wait, which one?
Which game?
That sounds like Katamari Damacy.
It sounds like Katamari Damacy.
It sounds like a genre.
Yes.
Yeah.
Get bigger so you can get bigger.
Yeah. Let's see. What's the game done by Andy Milan?
Orbis?
Osmos. I think that's a PC and portable device. Yeah. So that Osmos is an interesting situation because yes, the bigger you get, the bigger you can get, because the idea of Osmos is like you're just like the amoeba-like blob, so asteroid amoeba-like blob. You can eat anything smaller than you, and everything that you eat makes you bigger, so you can eat even bigger things. But actually, makes it more difficult for you to navigate. Because you're more massive now. So you actually have both negative and positive loops going on at once.
Well, I have another possibility too.
Mm-hmm.
Bombs.
Bombs?
Yeah, when something is exploding.
It makes other things explode.
Well, there's that, but there are also like some bombs work on nuclear bombs. Yeah, nuclear bombs work.
Oh, so like you're using an atomic bomb to set off a hydrogen bomb, that sort of thing.
Something like that.
Okay, you can sort of, positive feedback often happens, military conflict, right? You know, if you got overwhelming forces, you know, being, every engagement just makes the ratio, if everything goes according to military doctrine, every engagement is going to give you yet a greater advantage, theoretically. So, the way how this has been applied in games is, you know, just to make it literal, you have some sort of state of the game. Am I getting this right? Yeah. You have the state of the game. You have. See this? Wait, hold on. Let me just make sure I got this perfectly right. Here we go. You have some sort of scoring function. It doesn't have to be the literal score, but it has to be some way of assessing how close you are to some sort of goal. So either the short-term goal or the overall goal of a game, some sort of scoring function. And that goes into some sort of player input. There are some versions of this diagram that separates this into two things. That's kind of like the player decides what they're going to do and then actually executes the input. And that goes back in. Actually, there is one more stage. Sorry. There is one more stage, and that's the kind of the mechanical bias. So the state of the game can be revealed in some sort of scoring function. A player assesses what they want to do and then tries to execute it. That is filtered within the computers or the board games or the card games interpretation of what that input's going to do, and then that feeds back into game state, right? So for games like Mario Kart, you know, you perceive that you are doing you perceive you are doing badly because you're the last one. At the back of the 8 races, you drive your vehicle into one of those rotating boxes because you're deliberately steering into them because they're probably your only chance to be able to catch up again. You get usually something really really sweet because you're all the way behind, and the way how the game is designed, if you're all the way behind, you get all the best toys. You get all the every single tool that you need to be able to catch up is given to you when you're all the way at the back. That's the mechanic bias. All right, it gives you the right tool, and that affects game state because now you have this wonderful tool and you use it. Hopefully it works, you know, and then you gain a couple of places up in the race. So there are a couple of other examples that are a little bit, you know, clearer. So say basketball. if you've got a situation where you've got five people on each side, you could do a game where if you start to have a lead of 5 points, you lose a player. You know, someone's benched, you know? And if you lose that 5 points, right? So is that negative or is that positive?
Negative.
That's negative, right? Because you know, you're saying, all right, you are far enough ahead, we're going to take away one of your advantages. Is there another way to do negative feedback on that example? Instead of taking away a player?
Add another player to the others.
You can add another player to the other side, right? That's also negative feedback. You know, even though you're adding something, what you're really doing is you're going to give an advantage to someone who's not doing so well and does try to bring things to equilibrium. Positive feedback version of this would be...
Turn the 3-point line into the 4-point line for one of the teams.
It's
like being
on... Oh, okay, all right.
Every time you score a point, the other team loses a player.
Yeah, okay.
You're playing basketball?
I was thinking something more literal, like just giving the person who the team that's ahead extra players, right? You know, that's like you could do it. Every 5 points that you gain, you get one more player. And pretty soon you've got 2 more players, and pretty soon you've got 3 more players, and then
pretty soon you have 2 more players.
And then you just have more people than anyone can move on the basketball court, and as a result of that, you kind of win by default.
Some games have like a similar mechanism, like somebody's on fire and they make 3 shots in a row, and all of a sudden they're just like way better at playing.
They run faster. They jump a little higher. Yeah, and a computer game you can totally do.
Not really.
Do that. Well,
being on fire.
Being on fire.
In sports,
you
can talk about momentum.
Yeah.
Statistically, if you're throwing a good game, and you're doing better, like more and more pitches, better and better pitches. You are playing better.
But I'm wondering whether that's correlation or causation. It's like, if the reason why you're doing better because...
Right now they're thinking it's causation.
It's causation.
It's a new study that just came out.
But it definitely comes up in sort of sports psychology, right? You know,
yeah,
it's like you are sort of building on the mental momentum of doing well. And similarly, a team that's not doing well can lose hope. That's positive feedback. I just want to be extremely clear about the use of positive. It's like anything that sort of amplifies differences that already exist. So there are a couple of things to think about when it comes to feedback, especially as a problem-solving technique for design. So we've already talked about how negative feedback tries to bring things down to equilibrium. So it's a stabilizing force. If your game is like out of control and unpredictable and chaotic, negative feedback can sort of like rein things in a little bit. It's like, sure, maybe unpredictable, but it's not going to hurt me so bad. Or if somebody gets an advantage, it's not going to be a runaway advantage. Similarly, if your game's just kind of actually always hovering at equilibrium and nobody seems to be getting an advantage, then positive feedback mechanisms will destabilize that. It will make it more likely that somebody who gets an advantage will actually get a large advantage. And that could be a good thing if your game's kind of like dull and it's always just kind of hovering at the same level. There's a trade-off with that. Because any amount of feedback that you're adding into your game, especially if it's kind of automated feedback, this is something that your rules are automatically generating, can actually be taking control away from players. And as a result of that, might actually make the game less engaging. So even a game like this game is too stable, we're going to add some positive feedback mechanisms so that people who have an advantage can sort of capitalize on that advantage. But if that's not done right, then you've just got a situation where once someone starts winning, everybody else loses interest because there's no way that they can sort of catch up. So it destabilizes it in the point that, yeah, someone's going to win this game, whereas previously it's always stuck at equilibrium, but it's actually lost. But it's very easy to sort of lose people in that process because you've just created an automated system to take control away from that. So that's one danger of putting in a feedback system. Also,
we talked about bringing things down to equilibrium to sort of like make things a little bit easier for people to catch up or to make advantages a little bit less drastic. That can also make a game much longer, right? Because nobody gets an advantage. And depending on your win condition, depending on your end of game conditions, could actually just, you know, make it interminably long. You could take a half an hour game and make it a 1 hour game. So on the flip side, a positive feedback game can actually help rein in the length of the game. So if your game is currently taking, you know, an hour long or something like that, and your victory conditions happen to be on gaining an advantage over your the opponents, then a positive feedback system can help speed that along. Right? So, okay, maybe we can cut it down by half by just giving some advantages to the person who's ahead or penalizing the people who are behind. That's a interesting little side effect, which is because positive feedback builds on itself. If you have an advantage early on, like you have an early success, then positive feedback is going to be the mechanism that's going to help you build on that. On the other hand, if you have a negative feedback system in your game, which means everything's kind of being brought down to an equilibrium, but everyone's getting closer to actually finishing the game, but no one really has like a huge lead, then late successes mean a lot more. That last boost when you are near the final, the winning line, the finish line. That last boost of the before you hit the finish line on the very last round of Mario Kart means a lot, because the whole game is designed with this huge amount of negative feedback, and could make all the difference. If people have played Mario Kart, where that was pretty much the game, it was like those last 5 seconds of it. Someone just got hit with a blue shell in the last 5 seconds and, you know, had no chance to stop it then. So negative feedback prioritizes what happens late in the game, whereas positive feedback prioritizes what happens earlier on in the game. The strategies that you pick, the cards that you happen to draw and play right at the beginning of the game or something, positive feedback stresses that. And finally, always keep in mind that any interaction of game systems probably creates immersion feedback loops even if you hadn't designed them in. So what you want to do is you want to try to find them. There's a tool out there that I've seen some student teams use, and I don't know whether it's going to be useful for you. I'm just going to clue you in. Has anyone heard of causal loop diagrams? It's from economics. You have? It's a very simple concept. You just basically write in your variables in your game. And you can add in a few sort of in-between variables if you know how players are thinking about your game. So I've been using Mario Kart too much for an example. Let's pick another game with a obvious feedback loop that everyone in this room probably knows.
Chess,
the number of pieces. Okay, so number of pieces. Chess sort of influences the number of attack paths. Right, so which means number of pieces, it will influence the number of pieces being threatened, of your opponent's pieces being threatened. Which then influences the number of opponent pieces taken. Now, if I flick this around a little bit, I think I could make an argument that if I switch this to number of my own pieces rather than my own opponent pieces, then it connects. But not everything is a positive connection. Number of pieces that I have means if I have more pieces, I have more attack paths. Sort of. It's not exactly a linear connection. But you can sort of imagine on chess, right? I have more pieces than you. I have more ways to attack than you. If I have more ways to attack than you, then actually I have fewer pieces threatened because I get also more ways to defend. So I'm going to say defend or attack pass. But anything that I can attack, I can prevent from. I say, well, if you take this piece, then I'm just going to take the piece that you just used. And it's going to be a one-for-one trade, I'll still have more pieces than you. And so if I can, if fewer of my pieces are threatened, that means I can, let's see, if number of pieces are threatened goes down, then the number of pieces that I can take goes up.
Wait. No, not yours.
That's not right. I think
that should still be yours.
Hmm? Yes. The number of your pieces threatened goes down, the number of your pieces taken goes down as well.
Yeah.
So those two are positive.
Yes, yes, that's right. You are right. You are right. So, and that should just increase. And if the number of pieces taken goes down, if the number of pieces taken goes up, then I have fewer pieces. If I have fewer pieces taken, then I have more pieces. So we have two pluses and we have two minuses, which means overall this entire loop is called a reinforcing loop. Right? This is positive feedback loop. You can connect this to other things. Maybe in chess, I'm not terribly good at causal loop diagrams to begin with. But in chess, you might be able to connect it to other things like the positioning of pieces, for instance, or the value of pieces. And some of those might be reinforcing. And reinforcing is basically another way of saying it's a positive feedback loop. Another way that you can say is there's a balancing loop, which means actually a negative feedback loop, and that's usually depicted with a letter B. The students that I've seen use this well are students from like economics and management who actually learn that because they're trying to study things like supply chains and how a system works in an industry. And that's why they've already used this tool and then they can put it in. So it might be worth looking up. It might be a useful diagnostic tool for your game if you're just trying to figure out what are all of the different loops and just write out all of your variables and figure out whether things even up. Two negatives and two positives gives you a reinforcing loop. Positive, 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 positive gives you a reinforcing loop. Positive, positive, negative, and that's it, gives you a balancing loop. Basically, the negative, the overall add up to positive. So the one thing to keep in mind is that occasionally what happens is that you have something like a time delay, and that's the notation for a time delay. And that means things sometimes will end up oscillating because you have time lag. So you get a benefit in something. We had a game, for instance, where it was about climate change, and you can invest money into research. Yeah, at some point of time in a far, far future, that pays off, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to pay off right away. So so that may end up in situations where you start getting things like big fluctuations around. It's still sort of balancing in terms of equilibrium, but just like a thermostat that's very slow to respond, you might have something like a heater that warms up a room and it makes the room too warm before the sensor actually realizes that it's warm enough and then shuts it off, and then the room becomes really, really cold before the sensor realizes that it's too cold and then turns it back on again. And thus you get these oscillations. So keep in mind also things like time lag when you're drawing out these diagrams. How long does it take this advantage to turn into that advantage, or this increase to turn into that decrease? Any questions? Yeah.
So even though the terms are negative and positive feedback, usually it seems sort of weird because usually positive means like a multiplier greater than one, and negative means a multiplier between 0 and 1, in the sense that how much does your point lead really mean? Like how much, if I have a 1 point lead right now, if the positive feedback means this is really like a 2 point lead, because it's going to provide more for me later, and even though the game says it won't, but the negative wins often means I'm like, it's actually more like a half point lead because it means less than it really does. Whereas, like, some games like Power Grid, for instance, I know definitely have a case where sometimes negative feedback can literally be negative in the sense that, like, taking this lead right now could actually hurt me because of the game could actually, like, hurt me long.
Yeah, I think positive and negative, since it was originally inherited from maths, cybernetics, it's actually referring to like the differential, rather than the it's referring to the rate of change, right? So rather than the actual multiplier.
Yeah.
So that's something that that's some baggage that we've taken on. But it sort of does, and it's not because some people think negative feedback means bad, right? It's like, no, negative feedback could mean good, and could mean that a negative feedback for someone who's behind could be an advantage. So the terminology doesn't quite make it easy for everyone to use, but it's something that is currently in use. So it's good to know that game designers do use these terms.
You're talking about like control system, like positive bad.
A control system where positive feedback will be bad. Yeah, I think that's kind of the opposite of the word control. Yeah. chain reaction might be a great way to describe that, you know, for instance. Any other questions about these ideas? A lot of this stuff that I've been talking about is known as first order cybernetics, which is basically the system. It's doing its own thing happily, and if I'm taking a look at the system from the outside, you know, I don't really have any influence on how it's going to perform. But there is a second order, that whole school of second order cybernetics that I'm totally unfamiliar with, which actually takes into account having a person in the loop, which you would think would be a lot more applicable for games, especially games being played by people. But I admit I don't know much about second order cybernetics. So if you're interested in a research project or something like that, you know, a thesis or something like that, come and talk to me, and I would love to be able to find out more about that with you. All right. One final word. This is a very formal way of looking at game systems. Just as I just admitted that it doesn't take people's involvement in the process very well. It is not necessarily the case that the formal ways of looking at a system, just looking at how the rules interact, is necessarily always the best way to look at games. In many ways, in many occasions, it is actually not a useful technique. You know, I can have all of these systems in my rules, but if people are going to read my rules and interpret my rules, as you've already seen happen in this class, differently, then they may be motivated to do things that operate against my assumptions, because there's something else in my narrative, my aesthetic, in their own individual motivations. Like, if somebody wants to take down somebody else in the game just because they happen to hate that person, you know, and it's outside of the game rules, you know, then nothing in the rules is going to tell me that. But it's still going to affect how that game gets played. And I might want to take that into account. The game of diplomacy, for instance, you know, has to take into account the fact that that you're probably playing it with people that you know, and you have some sort of existing relationship with them. I don't think it does a very, very good job of insulating you from the fallout of the game. everyone knows what I'm talking about, right? Okay, just aren't friends with people that you play diplomacy with anymore. That's why I try to avoid playing that game, but I like talking about it. We'll be going into things like games for social play, and the social function of games, how you interact with people. Some other topics are going to be things like games as simulation, games as a slightly flawed mirror to the real world, but an interesting way, you know. But it could be a funhouse mirror, which could be fun. So we'll be looking at that in weeks ahead. This is probably about as formal as we get. We've been talking about things like information systems. That's also very formal. Just keep in mind, that's just like one school of game design and writing about game design. Okay. So we have games that all have an interesting way of dealing with this. Some of them, you are going to see these problems come up, like especially in three-player games. How many people we have in class today? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay. So 11, that's like one four person game. No, that's like 2 4-person games and 1 3 game. Okay. So we get about 3 games going on at once. Some games like King of Tokyo is very much a King of the Hill game, so it's deliberately trying to ask you to take down the person who's in the lead. And the game mechanics make you wonder whether being in the lead is really all that great. So it's playing around with this idea. Small World is occupying territory with your armies.
Yeah, the reading, they talked about Vinci. Small World is a update of Vinci.
Yeah. A little faster to play, fits better in this class. We have Vinci too, if anybody wants to take a look at that. We have that in our lab, but we don't play that often because it takes like 2 hours. Unless, of course, you already know the rules. Lifeboats, it's about a bunch of sailors trying to get to safety. Basically, their boat is sinking. Their boats are sinking, and they're all trying to get to safety, and everyone's jumping on and pushing people out of lifeboats. and swimming two lifeboats and stuff like that. So it's all about knocking people out. Hoity-toity and what was the last one?
Elgrand.
Yeah, I actually know relatively little about these ones. I forget. Hoity-toity is a game about bluffing. Okay. These were recommended by some other scholars when I shared with them.
Well, that's the same kind of basic stuff.
Yep.
And El Grande, Spanish game about being a calabero. I'm totally mangling that word.
Did you
type?
We have English rules in here.
Yes, we have English rules in here. Yeah, the box is German, but I'm pretty sure I looked in there earlier and I saw a pretty sheet of English rules. Intrigue is the game that I like the theme the most. It's basically you run a university and you're trying to put your postdocs in other universities. That's not what the game says in the box, but I would like you to try playing the game with that theme in mind. it's an interesting game because you are doing exactly the same thing that everybody else is trying to do, but in order to succeed in the game, you have to put your troops, your scholars, into other people's territory. And they are trying to put it into yours. And there's some mutual benefit and a whole lot of politicking. So a lot of opportunities for you to sort of, it's a pretty good negative feedback game because what it does, it gives you a whole bunch of tools to basically take the words in a read. Take a look at which games hide the win condition or hide the progress of players from you. You know, in some of these games you can easily see who's ahead. In some of these games it's really hard to tell, and that's deliberate. So that you don't have these situations where someone all gangs up on the people who are in the lead. Look at how they avoid things like turf playing and how they discourage things like sandbagging. Or maybe sometimes encourage them and use them in favor of the game. Like Intrigue definitely encourages sandbagging. All right. And then we'll have these boxes out at 3 o'clock. Working on our teams, it's going to be the last time you're going to see your teams before spring break, so you might want to give each other tasks to work on during spring break. If you can't think of anything, test over spring break. A good number of you are going to see people who haven't seen your game yet. Yeah. And,
especially if you have written rules, if you have a first draft of your written rules, it's great. This is a great opportunity to take a test that.
Yeah, and if you don't have a first draft of written rules, then this last hour of class is probably a good time to bring up a laptop and just like start editing that text so that you can go into spring break with something that you can test with. Alright?
And for the games King Tokyo, we'll probably be able to play twice, maybe you can play another game, but the other games are all about 40 minutes.
Yeah.
The
ground is longer?
The ground is probably 60, 90, the Small World is 40 to 80. The rest are about 40.
I'll play King of Tokyo.